How did you come to write this story? I am frequently asked, whether it be this story, or that one over there, or the soft pink and white one in the corner. Usually, I shrug helplessly. My ideas come from the same place yours come from, Compulsion City, about half an hour out of Schenectady. I can't give a more specific location than that. Once in a great while, I know specifically. The story that follows is one of those instances, and I will tell you. I attended the 22nd World Science Fiction Convention, PacificCon 2, on Labor Day, 1964. For the past many cons, a feature has been a fan art exhibit, with artwork entered by non-professionals from all over the science fiction world. Several times, for some as yet unexplained reason, I have been asked to be among the judges of this show, and have found the level of work to be pleasantly high, in some cases really remarkable. On half a dozen occasions, I've found myself wondering why a certain illustrator that impressed me was not working deep in the professional scene, and within a year, invariably, that artist has left the amateur ranks and become a selling illustrator. At the PacificCon, once again, I attended the fan art exhibition. I was in the company of Robert Silverberg, a writer whose name will not be unfamiliar to you, and the then editor of Amazing Stories, Seal Goldsmith Lally. The Lally had only recently been added, when that handsome bachelor lady finally threw in the sponge and married Mr. Lally, in whose direction Dirty Looks for absconding with one of the best editors SF had yet produced. Seal had been trying vainly to get a story out of me. I was playing coy. There had been days when the cent or cent and a half Amazing Stories paid was mucho dinero to me, but now I was a big-time Hollywood writer, it says here somewhere, and I was enjoying saying stupid things like, "You can't afford me, Seal," or, "I'll see if Joseph E. Levine will let me take off a week to write one for you." Seal was taking it staunchly. Since I was much younger and periodically disrupted her efficient Ziff Davis office, she had tolerated me with a stoic resign only faintly approached by the Colossus of Rhodes. "Okay, okay, big shot," she was replying. "I'll stretch it to 2 cents a word, and we both know you're being overpaid." I sneered and marched away. It was something of a running gun battle for 2 days, but in point of fact, I was so tied up with prior commitments in television, that was my term for menial servitude on the outer limits, that I knew I didn't have the time for short stories, much as I lusted to do a few to keep my hand in. That Sunday morning in September, we were at the fan art exhibit, and I was stopped in front of a display of scratchboard illustrations by a young man named Dennis Smith from Chula Vista, California. They were extraordinary efforts, combining the best features of Finlay, Lawrence, and Heinrich Clay. They were youthfully derivative, of course, but professionally executed, and one of them held me utterly fascinated. It was a scene on a foggy landscape with a milk wash of stars dripping down the sky, a dim outline of battlements in the distance, and in the foreground, a weird phosphorescent creature with great luminous eyes, holding a bag of skulls astride a giant rat padding toward me. I stared at it for a long while, and a small group of people clustered behind me also held by the picture. "If somebody would buy that, I'd write the story for it," I heard myself say. And from behind me, Seal Goldsmith Lally's margarine warm voice replied, "I'll buy it for Fantastic. You've got an assignment." I was trapped. Hell hath no fury like the wrath of an editor with single-minded devotion to duty. Around that strange, remarkable drawing, I wrote a story, one of my personal favorites. Dennis Smith had named the picture, so I felt it only seemly to title the story the same. Bright Eyes. Feet without toes. Softly padded feet, furred. Footsteps sounded gently, padding furry down ink-chill corridors of the place. a place Bright Eyes had inhabited since before time had substance, since before places had names, a dark place, a shadowed place, only a blot against the eternally nightened skies. No stars, Chip Ice twittered insanely against that night, for in truth, the night was mad enough. Night was a condition Bright Eyes understood, and he knew about day. He knew about almost everything. The worms, the moles, the trunks of dead trees, the whites of eggs, music, and random sounds. The sound fish make in the deep, the flares of the sun, the scratch of unbleached cloth against flesh, the hounds that roamed the tundra. The way those who have hair see it go pale and stiff with age, clocks and what they do, ice cream, wax seals on parchment dedications, grass and leaves, metal and wood, up and down, here and most of there. Bright Eyes knew it all. And that was the reason his padding, acoustically susurrating footsteps, hissed high in the dark, beamed, silent corridors of the place, and why he would now, forever at last, make that long journey. The giant rat, whose name was Thomas, lay curled, fetid, sleeping near the great wooden gate, and as Bright Eyes approached, it stirred. Then, like a mastiff, it lifted its bullet-shaped head, and the bright crimson eyes flickered artful awareness. The massive head stiffened on the necklace neck, and it shambled to its feet. The wire tail swished across hand-inset cobblestones, making scratching sounds in the silent night. "It's time," Bright Eyes murmured. "Here, Thomas." The great gray creature jogged to him, nuzzling Bright Eyes' leg. It sniffed at the net filled with old skulls, and its whiskers twitched like cilia for a moment. Bright Eyes swung the great wooden gate open with difficulty, dislodging caked dirt and cold-hardened clots of stray matter. The heavy metal ring clanged as he dropped it against the portal. Then Bright Eyes swung to the back of the rat, and without reins or prompting, the rat, whose name was Thomas, paced steadily through the opening, leaving behind the only home Bright Eyes had ever known, which he would never see again. There was mist on the land. Strange and terrible portents had caused Bright Eyes to leave the place. Unwilling to believe what they implied at first, Bright Eyes pursued the gentle patterns of his days, like all the other days he had ever known, alone. But finally, when the blood-red and gray colors washed in unholy mixture down the skies, he knew what had happened, and that it was his obligation to return to a place he had never seen, had only heard about from others centuries before, and do what had to be done. The others were long since dead. Had been dead since before Christ took Barabbas's place on the cross. The place to which Bright Eyes must return had not even been known, had not even existed, when the others left the world. Yet it was Bright Eyes' place, by default, and his obligation to all the others who had passed before. Since he was the last of his kind, a race that had no name, and had dwelled in the castle place for millennia, he only dimly understood what was demanded of him. Yet this he knew. The call had been made. The portents cast into the night to be seen by him, and he must go. It was a journey whose length even Bright Eyes could not surmise. The mist seemed to cover the world in a soft shroud that promised little good luck on this mission. And inexplicably, to Bright Eyes, there was a crushing sadness in him, a sadness he did not fathom, could not plumb, dared not examine. His glowing sight pierced through the mist as steadily and stately Thomas moved toward Bright Eyes' final destination, and it would remain unknown till he reached it. Out of the mist, the giant rat swung jauntily. They had passed among softly rounded hills with water that dripped from above. Then the shoulders had become black rock, and gleaming pinpoints of diamond brilliance had shone in the rock, and Bright Eyes had realized they were in caves. But had they come from the land, inside, or had they come from some resting land deep in the bowels of the earth into these less hidden caverns, and would they continue to another outside? Far ahead, a dim light pulsed and glowed, and Bright Eyes spurred Thomas forward. The dim light grew more bold, more orange and yellow and menacing with sudden soft roars of bubbling thunder, and as they rounded the passage, the floor of the cave was gone, and in their path lay a boiling scar in the stone. A lava pit, torn up out of the solid stone, hissing and bubbling fiercely with demonic abandon. The light burned at Bright Eyes, and the heat was gagging. The sour stench of sulfur bit at his senses, and he made to turn aside. The giant rat suddenly bolted in panic, arching back, more like a caterpillar than rodent, and Bright Eyes was tossed to the floor of the cave, his net of skulls rolling away from him. Thomas chittered in fear, and took steps away, then paused, and returned to his master. Bright Eyes rose and patted the terrified beast several times. Thomas fell into quivering silence. Bright Eyes retrieved the skulls. All but one that had rolled across the stone floor and disappeared with a vagrant hiss into the flame pit. The giant rat sniffed at the walls, first one, then the other, and settled against the far one. Bright Eyes contemplated the gash in the stone floor. It stretched completely across and, as far as he could tell, forward. Thomas chittered. Bright Eyes looked away from the flames into the fear-streaked eyes of the beast. "Well, Thomas?" he asked. The rat's snout twitched, and it hunkered closer to the wall. It looked up at Bright Eyes imploringly. Bright Eyes came to the rat, crouched down, stroked its neat, tight fur. Bright Eyes brushed the wall. It was not hot. It was cool. The rat knew. Bright Eyes rose, walked back along the passage. He found the parallel corridor half a mile back in the direction they had come. Without turning, he knew Thomas had silently followed, and leading the way, he moved down the parallel corridor in coolness. Even the earth could not keep Bright Eyes from what had to be done. They followed the corridor for a very long time, till the rock walls leaned inward and the littered floor tilted toward the stalactite spiked ceiling. Bright Eyes dismounted and walked beside the giant rat. There were strange, soft murmurings beneath them. Thomas chittered every time the earth rattled. Farther on, the passage puckered narrower and narrower, and Bright Eyes was forced to bend, then stoop, then crawl. Thomas slithered, belly tight behind him, more frightened to be left behind than to struggle forward. A whisper of chill, clean air passed them. They moved ahead, only the glow of Bright Eyes marking a passage. Abruptly, the cave mouth opened onto darkness and cold, and the world Bright Eyes had never seen, the world his dim ancestors had left millennia before. No one could ever set down what that first sight meant to Bright Eyes. But the chill he felt was not the chill of the night wind. The countryside was a murmuring silence. The sky was so black, not even the stars seemed at home. Frightened, lonely, and alienated from the universe they populated, the silver specks drifted down the night like chalk dust. And through the strangeness, Bright Eyes rode Thomas, neither seeing nor caring. Behind him, a village passed over the horizon line, and he never knew he had been through it. No shouts of halt were hurled on the wind. No one came to darkened windows to see Bright Eyes pass through. He was approaching there and gone, all in an instant of time that may have been forever and may have been never. He was a wraith on the mist-bottomed silence, and Thomas moved stately through valley and village, only paced, nothing more. From now on, it was Brighteyes' problem. Far out on the plains, the wind opened up suddenly. It spun down out of the northwest and drove at Brighteyes' back, and on the trembling coolness, the alien sounds of wild dogs came snapping across the emptiness. Brighteyes looked up, and Thomas's neck hair bristled with fear. Brighteyes stroked a round, palpitating ear, and the great rat came under control. Then, almost without sound that was tied to them, for the sound of dogs came from a distance, from far away, the insane beasts were upon them. A slavering band of crimson-eyed mongrels, some still wearing dog collars and clinking tags, hair grown shaggy and matted with filth, noses with large nostrils, as though they had had to learn to forage the land all at once rather than from birth. These were the dogs of the people, driven out onto the wind to live or die or eat each other as best they could. The first few leaped from 10 feet away, high and flat, in trajectories that brought them down on Thomas's back, almost into Brighteyes' lap, their yellow teeth scraping and clattering like dice on cement, lunacy bubbling out of them as froth and stench and spastic claw scrabblings. Thomas reared, and Brighteyes slid off without losing balance, using the bag of skulls as a mace to ward off the first of the vicious assaults. One great Doberman had its teeth set for a strike into Thomas's belly, but the great rat, with incredible ferocity and skill, snapped its head down in a scythe-like movement and rent the gray-brown beast from jowl to chest, and it fell away, bleeding, moaning piteously. And the rest of the pack materialized from the darkness, dozens of them circling warily now that one of their number lay in a trembling wet garbage heap of its own innards. Brighteyes whistled Thomas to him with a soft sound. They stood together, facing the horde, and Brighteyes called up a talent his race had not been forced to use in uncounted centuries. The great white eyes glowed, deep and bubbling as cauldrons of lava, and a hollow moaning came from a place deep in Brighteyes' throat. A sound of torment, a sound of fear. An evocation of gods that were dust before the earth began to gather moisture to itself in the senseless cosmos, before the moon had cooled, before the patterns of magnetism had settled the planets of the solar system in their sockets. Out of that sound, the basic fiber of emotion, like some great machine phasing toward top point efficiency, Brighteyes drew himself tight and unleashed the blast of pure power at the dogs. Buried deep in his mind, the key to pure fear as a weapon was depressed, and in a blinding fan of sweeping brilliance, the emotion washed out toward the horde, a comber of undiluted, unbuffered terror. For the first time in centuries, that immense power was unleashed. Brighteyes thought them terrified, and the air stank with fear. The dogs, bulge-eyed and hysterical, fled in a wave of yipping, trembling, tuck-tailed quivering. As if the night could no longer contain the immensity of it, the shimmering sound of terror bulged and grew, seeking release in perhaps another dimension, some higher threshold of audibility. And finding none, it wisped away in darkness and was gone. Brighteyes stood trembling uncontrollably, every fiber of his body spasming. His pineal gland throbbed. An intracranial tumor, whose presence in a human brain would have meant death, absolutely imperative for Brighteyes' coordinated thought processes, which had swollen to 5 times its size as he concentrated, till his left temple had bulged with the pressing growth of it, now shrank, subsided, sucked itself back down into the gray brain matter, the gliomas itself. And slowly, as the banked fires of his eyes softened once more, Brighteyes came back to full possession of himself.
"It has been a very long time since that was needed," he said gently,
and dwelt for a moment on the powers his race had possessed, powers long since gone to forgetfulness. Now that it was over, the giant rat settled to the ground, licking at its fur, at a slash in the flesh where one of the mad things had ripped and found meat. Bright Eyes went to him.
"They are the saddest creatures of all. They are alone."
Thomas continued licking at his wounds. Days later, but closer to their final destination, they came to the edge of a great river. At one time, it had been a swiftly moving stream, whipping itself high in a pounding torrent filled with colors and sounds, but now it flushed itself to the sea wearily, riding low in its own tide trough and hampered by the logjam. The logjam was made of corpses, bodies hideously bloated and maggot white, puffed out of human shapes, lay across one another from the near shore to the opposite bank. Thousands of bodies, uncountable thousands, twisted and piled and washed together till it would have been possible to cross the river on the top layer of naked men's faces, bleached women's backs, twisted children's hands crinkled as if left too long in water. For they had been. As far upstream as Bright Eyes could see, and as far downstream as the bend of the banks permitted, it was the same. No movement, save the very seldom jiggle of a corpse as the water passed through. For they were packed so deep and so tight that in truth only water at its most sluggish could wanly press through. Yet the water gurgled and twittered among them, stealing slowly downstream, caressing rotting flesh in obscene parody. Water, cleansing stepping stones, polishing and smoothing, and drenching them senselessly as it marks its passage only by what is left behind. That was the ultimate horror of this river of dead, that the tide, no matter how held back now, continued unheeding as it had since the world was born. For the world went on and did not care. Bright Eyes stood silently. At the bottom of the short slope that ended with shoreline, bodies were strewn in a jackstraw tumble. He breathed very deeply, fighting for air, and the shivering started again. As it grew more pronounced, there was movement in the dry, moist riverbed. Bodies abruptly began to move. They trembled, as though roiling in a stream growing turbulent. Then, one by one, they rearranged themselves. All up and down the length of the river, the bodies shifted and moved and lifted without aid from their original positions, and far off, where their movement to neatness could not be seen, there came the roar of dammed-up water breaking free, surging forward, freed from its restraining walls of once human flesh. As Bright Eyes trembled, power surging through his slight frame, his eyes seeming to wax and wane with currents of electricity, the river of corpses freed itself from its logjam and was open once more. The water poured in a great frothing wave down and down the corpse-bordered trough of the river. It broke out of a box canyon to Bright Eyes' left like a wild creature penned too long and at last set free on the wind. It came bubbling, boiling, threshing forward past the spot where he stood and hurled itself away around the bend in the shoreline. As Bright Eyes felt the trembling pass, the river rose and rose and gently now rose, covering the ghastly residue of humanity that now lay submerged beneath the mud-blackened waters. The eyes of the trembling creature, the eyes of the giant rat, the eyes of the uncaring day were blessedly relieved of the sight of decay and death. Emotions washed quickly, one after another, down his features, washed as quickly as the river had concealed its sad wealth. Colors of sadness, imprinted in a manner no human being could ever have conceived, for the face that supported these emotions was of a race that had vanished before man had walked the earth.
Then Bright Eyes turned, and with the rat, walked upstream toward the morning. When the bleeding birds went over, the sun darkened. Great, irregular, hard-edged clouds of them, all species, all wingspreads, but silent. Passing across the broad gray brow of the sky, heading absolutely nowhere, they turned off the sun. It was suddenly chill as a crypt. Heading east, not toward warmth or instinct or destination, just anywhere. Nowhere, until they wearied, expired, dropped, not manna, garbage, live garbage that fell in 100 clots from the beat-winged flights. Many dropped, fluttering idly as if too weary to fight the air currents any longer, as though what tiny instinctual brain substance they had possessed was now baked, turned to jelly, squashed by an unnameable force into an Icarus juice that ran out through their eyes, as though they no longer cared to live, much less to continue this senseless flight east to nowhere. And they bled. A rain of birds' blood, sick and discolored. It misted down, beating Bright Eyes and the stiff rat fur and the trees and the still, silent, dark land. Only the dead, flat, no sound of millions of wings metronomically beating, beating, beating. Bright Eyes shuddered, turned his face from the sight above, and finding himself unable to look, yet unable to end the horror, as he had the mad dogs or the water of corpses, sought surcease in his own personal vision, and this, which had driven him forth, was his vision. Sleeping, deep in that place where he had lived so long, Bright Eyes had felt the subtle altering of tempo in the air around him. It was nothing as obvious as machinery beginning to whir, trembling the walls around him, nor as complex as a shift in dimensional orientation. It was rather a soft sliding in the molecules of everything except Bright Eyes. For an instant, everything went just slightly out of sync, a little fuzzy, and Bright Eyes came awake sharply. The thing that had occurred was something his race had preset eons before. It was triggered to activate itself, whatever itself was, after certain events had possibly happened. The fact that this shifting had occurred made Bright Eyes grow cold and wary. He had expected to die without its ever having come, but now, this was the time, and it had happened. And he waited for the next phase. It came quickly, the vision. The air before him grew even more indistinct, more roiled, like a pool of quicksilver smoke tumbling in and in on itself, and from that cloudiness the image of the last of the Castellans took shape. Was it image, or reality, or thought within his head? He did not really know, for Bright Eyes was merely the last of his kind, no specially trained adept, and much of what his race had been and knew was lost to him, beyond him. The Castellan was a 5th degree adept, and surely the last remaining one of Bright Eyes' race to go. He wore the purple and blue of royalty from a house Bright Eyes did not recognize, but the cut of the robe was shorter than styles Bright Eyes recalled as having been current then. And the Castellan's cowl was up, revealing a face that was bleak with sorrow and even a hint of cruelty. Such was not present, of course, for the Castellans merely performed their duties, but Bright Eyes was certain this adept had been against the decision to go. Yet he had been chosen to bring the message to Bright Eyes. He stood, booted and silent, in the soft-washed blue and white lightness of Bright Eyes' sleeping chamber. Bright Eyes was given time to come to full wakefulness, and then the Castellan spoke. What you see has been gone for 10 centuries. I am the last, save you.
They have set me the task and this twist of my being of telling you what you must do. If the proper portents trigger my twist to appear before you, pray it never happens, then you must go to the city of the ones with hair, the ones who come after us, the ones who inherit the earth, the men. Go to their city with a bag of skulls of our race. You will know what to do with them. Know this, Bright Eyes. We go voluntarily. Some of us, and I am one of them, more reluctantly than most. It is a decision that seems only proper. Those who come after us, men, will have their chance for the stars. This was the only gift of birth we could offer. No other gift can have meaning between us. They must have our chance. So we have gone to the place where you now lie. By the time I appear to you, if ever I do, we will be gone. This is the way of it. A sad and inescapable way. You will be the last. And now I will show you a thing. The castellan raised his hands before his face, and as though they were growing transparent, they glowed with an inner fire. The visioning power. The castellan's face suffused with flames as it conjured up the proper vision for Bright Eyes. It appeared out of lines of blossoming crimson force in the very air beside the castellan, a vision of terror and destruction. Flames man-made and devastating, incredible in their hellfire. Like some great arachnid of pure force, the demon flames of the destruction swept and washed across the vision, and when it faded, Bright Eyes lay shaken by what he had seen. If this that I have showed you ever comes to pass, then my twist will appear to you. And if you ever hear me as you hear me now, then go with the bag of skulls of our people, and do not doubt your feelings. For if I appear to you, it will all have been in vain, and those of us who were less pure in our motivations will have been proved right. Shimmering substance, coalescing nothingness, air that trembled and twittered and reforming, and the castellan was gone. Bright Eyes rose and gathered the skulls from the crypt. Then, feet without toes, softly padded feet, furred. Footsteps sounded gently, padding furry down ink-chill corridors of the place. A place Bright Eyes had inhabited since before time had substance. He walked through night out of the place. Night was a condition Bright Eyes understood, and he knew about day. The bleeding birds were long since gone. Bright Eyes moved through the days and onward. At one point he passed through a sector of trembling mountains that heaved up great slabs of rock and hurled them away like epileptics ridding themselves of clothes. The ground trembled and burst and screamed, and the very earth went insane to tunes of destruction it had never written. There was a plain of dead grass, sere and wasted with great heaps of desiccated insects heaped here, there. They had flocked together to the last resting place, and the plain of dead grass was poor tapestry indeed to hold the imprisoned pigments of their dead flesh. The acrid and bittersweet pervasive odor of formic acid that lingered like hot breath of a mad giant across the silent, windless emptiness. Yet, how faint, a sound of weeping? Finally, Bright Eyes came to the city. Thomas would not enter. The twisted rope pillars of smoke that still climbed relentlessly to the dark sky, the terrible sounds of steel cracking and masonry falling into empty streets, the charnel house odor. Thomas would not go in, but Bright Eyes was compelled to enter into that last debacle of all from where it had begun. The dead were everywhere, sighing soundlessly with milk-white eyes at a tomorrow that had never come,
and each fallen one soundlessly spoke the question of why. Brighteyes walked with the burden of chaos pulsing in him. This is what it had come to. For this, his race had gone away. That the ones with hair, the men they had called themselves, could stride the earth. How cheap they had left it all. How cheap, how thin, how sordid. This was the last of it, the last of the race of men. Dust and dead. Down a street, woman pleading out of death for mercy. Through what had been a park, old men humped crazily in rigorous failure to escape. Past a structure, building front ripped away as if fingernails had shorn it clean. Children's arms, pocked and burned, dangling. Tiny hands. To another place. Not like the place from which Brighteyes had come, but the place to which he had journeyed. No special marker, just a place. Sufficient. And then it was that Brighteyes sank to his knees, crying. Tears that had not been seen since before man had come from caves. Tears that Brighteyes had never known. Infinite sadness. Cried. Cried for the ghosts of the creatures with hair. Cried for men. For man. Each man. The man who had done away with himself so absurdly, so completely. Brighteyes on his knees, sorrowing for the ones who had lived here and were gone, leaving him to the night and the silence and eternity. A melody never to be heard again. He placed the skulls down in the soft white ash, unresponsive, dying earth, receiving its burden testament. Brighteyes, last of a race that had condemned itself to extinction, had condemned him to living in darkness forever, and had had only the saving, wistful knowledge that the race coming after would live in the world. But now, gone, all of them, taking the world with them, leaving instead, no fair exchange, charnel house. And Brighteyes, alone. Not only their race had been destroyed, in vain, but his. Centuries turned to mud and diamonds in their markerless graves had passed in futility. It had all of it, been for nothing. So Brighteyes, never man, was the last man on earth. Keeper of a silent graveyard. Echoless tomb monument to the foolishness, the absurdity of nobility.